Welcome to Cogitations, a show where each week your host, anthropologist and UC Davis faculty Tarek El-Haik, encounters and talks with fellow thinkers, composers, philosophers, visual artists, filmmakers, and media scholars who cogitate with images, concepts, and forms. These cogitations are more than reflections. They are an expression of a way of life, an antidote to our dimmed access to the infinite, and an invitation to a joyful experience of our finitude. The show takes its name from a concept that has been key in both the philosophical work of the 12th century polymath Averroes and the interplanetary music of composer Sun Ra. Cogitations sound like the enchanting voices, songs, and music of birds of flames that have entered into our dark world. Well, hello everyone. Welcome back to Radio Cogitations. This has certainly been an intense period where we had to contend with a number of difficulties that that have transformed the way we relate to ourselves and to others. And certainly this is going to be an interesting week for those of us who live on this part of the world. We have an upcoming elections and may the force be with us. So don't forget to vote. That's something that I cannot repeat enough. I am very excited today to welcome Benedetta Cestelli-Guidi, who will be my guest for the next hour or so. And we are going to be talking about an important 20th century intellectual who has been important for Benedetta and myself and a few other art historians and anthropologists in recent years. Benedetta Cestelli-Guidi has a bachelor's in art history from La Sapienza University in Rome and a master's degree from the Warburg Institute in London, as well as a doctoral degree from the University of Siena in Italy. Her research focuses on art criticism, contemporary photography, and historical photographic archives. She's also interested in exhibition displays and thinking about how to exhibit objects and photographic images in particular. She has extensively worked on Abby Warburg, and her work has in fact enhanced our understanding of his American journey. And she focuses in particular to the way Warburg has designed a particular kind of visual method to think about how we produce visual narratives and how we use images and display those images and think with and through images. She has worked on photography, on cultural heritage, and has also reflected on museography and practices of exhibition in museum settings, and is currently teaching seminars on cultural heritage and documentary photography at the Scuola di Specializzazione in Beni Storici and Artistici of La Sapienza University in Rome. In the last 10 years, she has been engaged with photography in the archive, collaborating with the Ministry of Cultural Affairs and Cultural Heritage, and she does so on various levels. And needless to say, she has written extensively scholarly essays and collaborated on projects and exhibitions by contemporary photographers. She's also the co-curator and collaborator on an amazing project that we will be discussing today, Abby Warburg, an Unexpected Influencer. Benedetta, welcome to Radio Cogitations.
Hello. Thank you so much for your introduction, Tarek. I'm really glad to be part of your series of conversation. And from Italy, things are changing really fast. And we are undergoing a new, very difficult possible lockdown for the second autumn coronavirus pandemic. So let's hope to see each other very soon, not on screen, not on radio, but live.
I certainly hope so, Benedetta. I'm really excited that you are on the show today. So I have obviously, you know, a number of questions that I would like to ask, but yes. Let's begin with a question that has to do with the nature of research desire, which is a very, very interesting and complex way of approaching the things that we study and we dedicate our lives to. So first of all, before I ask you more specific and technical questions about Warburg, I'm very curious to hear about how you first encountered Abby Warburg and how you became interested in his work and dedicated so much intellectual energy on him.
Yes, well, actually in La Sapienza, in the Department of Fine Arts of La Sapienza, there has been a good school of iconology studies. So there were at least part of the teachers there when I was a student who had written and thought and talked about Warburg's methodology, and not only Warburg's, of course, Panofsky's and Bing and Yeats, Saxler, Wind, up to Gombrich. So we had in La Sapienza one of the, you know, a really relevant intellectual criticism of that particular field of art history or history of culture, we would say. So that was the very beginning of it. And after my degree, my BA, I got a grant and went to do my MA at the Warburg Institute in London, which was by then the place which I really wanted to see and whose library was really my dream, basically. And so I spent a year there, and it was very unfortunate because by then the art history teacher was in sabbatical year. So I actually had no one from my own disciplinary team topic to sort of guide me. So I basically had to, I chose something completely, well, quite different, which had to do with educational treatises in 16th century Venice. So that was something far out of my reach somehow, but also very interesting because it just came out of the library itself. You know, from Rome, I had no idea that I could be interested in how a noble Venetian man could be educated. So that was really something that I learned out of that physical setting, which is the Warburg shelves. And after my MA, I was offered a few jobs from the Institute, some of them boring, you know, jobs that you do just to keep on doing research. And then this project came out, and the project was directed then by Nicholas Mann, who was then the director of the Warburg Institute. He came from Cambridge, a petrarchist, a well-known petrarchist. And so he proposed me to look into the archive of A.B. Warburg, specifically the archive, the boxes where all the materials from the American journey that Warburg underwent at the end of 19th century were kept and had been kept since, well, we don't know since when, but definitely since after his death and since the arrival of the materials in London, 1933, and were very seldom have been opened and used, even looked at, I would say. So when Nicholas offered me a part-time position on that, it was a really interesting time for the Warburg Institute because Nicholas was the one who basically opened up the historical archive of Warburg himself, which had been locked down for decades. The Warburg Institute didn't have an archivist by then. So Nicholas was the one, the first who appointed one, and through which Dorothea McEwen, through which basically everything was made, was put in order. I was able to work in it, thanks to the fact that actually she was there and, you know, sort of guiding me through all the materials, because Warburg himself kept everything. And when I mean everything, Tarek, I mean really every single object, even, you know, train tickets or receipts and letters. And so the American travel was basically the material of the American journey was kept in these three enormous boxes, among which there were these negatives, these 4x5 inch Kodak films, which were known because he had lectured on using the images of the journey, and part of them were printed later after his death, but basically most of it were not known to anybody. And so I started sort of digging in this archive, and the situation at the Warburg Institute was very peculiar at the time. You have to imagine a place where the sort of the Gombrich inheritance was very, very present, which means that basically all the professors that were there, it is an undergraduate institution, yeah? So sort of third level institution. So PhD, MA students, and the professors, librarians. So all those professors and librarians, the photographic archive, were ruled by his Cambridge favorite pupils, what he called New Turks. So those that were actually, you know, looking back to the tradition of the Warburg studies and telling that, you know, possibly it wasn't really correct, or, you know, there was a very, very strong criticism. And especially Warburg himself had been completely erased from the discourse in the Institute. So when Nicholas set up this project and asked me to deal with the photographs and the American travel, the first thing that I did was, as a student, I was in my late 20s by then, was to go to the, you know, to the teachers, to professors, and ask them what they knew about it. You know, if there was anything that was had been passed through that I may be, you know, may be useful more for my research. And the response was always, there is, you know, why are you doing it? You know, what's the point in it? You know, we all know that it doesn't make sense because, you know, Warburg is this sort of a very weak from the point of view of method and synthesis, and scholarly production is a very weak intellectual. So, you know, what's all this fuss about? So for 2 years, I've been working basically in my studio with these materials. I was helped very much by confrontation with American scholars working then on, you know, on issues similar, museums curators who had, you know, massive collection of Pueblo artifacts, which is basically the nation, the Amerindian tribe that Warburg was interested into. So I got, you know, much help from anthropologists dealing with photography. Elizabeth Edwards, for instance, was one of the first to whom I'd shown the photographs. And but from the inside institution, that seems to be a very, very weird sort of interest.
I think it would be interesting to spend a little bit of time for those in the audience who are not familiar with the Warburg Institute and the Warburg Library, if you can tell us a little bit about just the way it is organized in a rather unusual way. If I remember correctly, and to my chagrin, I have never visited the Warburg Institute, but to my understanding is that it is the material, the books, the images are organized in a way that each floor has a different name. Could you tell us a little bit about the kind of classificatory logic or lack of it that animates Warburg's initial vision of how this material should be organized under the conventional name of library? Why do you think library is the term that he chose? And at the same time, it seems to me that he expands the concept of the library by, so just a little bit, and then we'll get to Gombrich and
yes. Okay. So, as you know, Warburg, before Warburg is from Hamburg, Germany. He comes from a very, very wealthy family of bankers. And in the late, in the mid-20s, decides to open up his own institution, which is called the Kulturwissenschaftliche Bibliothek Warburg. So it's the library for the history. Is a library for the history of science called after him, which opens up in Hamburg in a building which he had designed by an architect, whose main, at the entrance of it, there is Mnemosyne as a sort of word that opens up to the library. The library was shaped as a rounded space, so it has the shape of the cosmos. And around the main reading room, there were the books, which were divided by topics. So there is no chronological intention in ordering the book. But there is a thematic idea. So, for instance, if you are interested in astrology, given that we are in this very peculiar time, if you were interested in astrology and in all the fields where astrology has been studied, even in the figurative arts, you would have all the books dealing with the topic of astrology. It doesn't really matter whether they are old manuscript or explanation of works of art. They are all gathered together according to a law that Warburg defined of the good neighborhood, which means that basically, if you're looking for a book and you find it, but you haven't thought that from that book, you may open up a new path of research that, let's say, from Arab astrology goes to 15th century depiction of the months in Roman palaces. If you haven't thought about it because you're not interested in paintings or in afterlives of tradition, of astrological tradition in time, you may, but you do find a book which may be your guide, a sort of Virgil that opens up a new path of research. So basically, the library, I mean, the books were gathered together according to topics, which resonates of Warburg's own interests and after Warburg's of the other scholars which worked in the library interests. So basically is an ever-growing library which expands and also and the opposite
Contracts.
and contracts, thanks, and contracts according on how much you feed it. So basically is a lively organism. And when Warburg died in 1929, and Fritz Saxler took the direction of the library and then decided to move the entire library, which means not only the book, but also the photographic archive, whose structure is identical to that of the library. So basically, the photo archives is divided by teams, again, in which case, they are sort of easier to be found, so they can be subject matters, for instance, the figure of Venus, to just mention one. So when they moved it to London, they then put it in order again only at the end of the Second War, I think in 43 or 45,
44. 44.
44, when the Warburg Library became part of University of London. And then they disposed the books in the five levels of the building in Woburn Square according to Warburg's own method. So is it a system or not, to answer to your question? Well, it is completely a new system, and it's also it can't be systematized. because it sort of breathes out, you know, it breathes according to those who are working in the library itself.
Mm-hmm. What I find very interesting about the organization of the library, and again, my understanding is that floors are named in a specific way. And I'm not sure if that organization is still in place. First floor image, second floor word, fourth floor yes. action orientation. And then within the fourth floor, you have action and orientation, right? So the question about this, you know, kind of really intriguing mode of organization suggests a couple of things. Again, this is just a quick summary for those in the audience who are not familiar with Warburg's work, is that he was interested in giving a particular kind of prominence to images over words. And what I find puzzling about this particular mode of organization and mode of juxtaposition is that it, on the one hand, it relies on a deep engagement with classical anthropology in particular. And I think that E.B. Tyler and Franz Boas, I think, are key interlocutors for the young art historian with a very complicated history of nervous breakdowns and disorders that will lead us to talk later on about Montage, that there is this link between Montage and modernism and mental illness also that we see at work in the organization of the yes. library itself. So I would it be too far-fetched to suggest that there is a logic of images or a curatorial logic in the work of Warburg, that he was a curator avant la lettre to a certain extent?
Well, Tarek, I'm happy that you're saying that, because you know one of the problem with dealing with some of the works that Warburg had done, and especially the Mnemosyne Bilder Atlas up until now, has been that it has been at the center of the discussion of a scholarly discourse. So, you know, scholars, art historians, historians, philosophers, even anthropologists, have been looking at that work as if it was a piece of paper, you know, a sort of a something written, an essay by a scholar for a scholarly audience. And what it has become really, I think, pretty evident now is that that work has attracted much more artists and creative processes and people that are working with images, so lens-based artists, than it has to scholars by nowadays. So we are beginning now to look at the structure of the library, which the first floor is image. So actually what we perceive of reality is through visuality. So that's how we can grasp something, especially if we work as Warburg did with cultures of the past, traditions, old tradition. It's a survival in contemporary time. So what we have left mostly are books on the one hand, but images on the other. And since he was an art historian, images are what his, you know, his sort of understanding of the world is based on a visual perception of it. So the Atlas as a work of a curator, I do agree with you. And I think that the response, for instance, you know that now there is this fantastic show in Berlin, which is the exposition of the panels of the Memory Atlas. Called, the subtitle is The Original, because basically the Warburg Institute, together with two scholars, German scholar, have philologically found in the photographic archive of the Institute in London, the original photographs and reproduction that were used by Warburg himself up to 1929 to compose the panels. So basically
1929 being the year where he passed, right?
He dies by a heart attack quite young, actually, and he was just back to work. So basically they rebuilt this amazing oeuvre, we can call it, like really a work of art, which is made out of 63 panels, 2 meters for 1 meter 80, blackboards with all these photographs pinched on it. And there is no text. So basically you had to go through, you had to surf these panels only visually. And in this exhibition in Berlin, you also got something which I think is really relevant as an experience of the work, which is the different materiality of the photographs. And therefore you've got colors, you've got different prints. So you've got albumen prints, newspapers, clippings, alinari photographs, gelatin silver print. So you've got also this perception that we didn't have up until now, because up until now it was reproduced as a black and white thing. So basically it was quite a fatigue to go through all these panels, which are very dense with these images mounted on them, these photographs. But now you've got also these, you know, sort of tonalities and colors. So the work is coming out as a real performative, so, you know, exposition of b-dimensional images through which he tries. So why did he do the atlas? To me, sometimes if you think about it, having read millions of things which are trying to philologically dig each panel and give a sort of a complete sense to each of them. To me, it's like, you know, you've got a photographic archive and you decide to put it, to put it in vertical, basically, to put it on walls. And you sort of build up a sort of possible fil rouge in between, you know, in each panel and in between different panels. And they're basically, it is a fragmentary sort of memory of his own work, because what you find in the panels are basically the photographs which he himself had used or worked on in his essays or in his research project, some of which were already published, some of which were just starting. So basically the Atlas is a really a sort of on progress work. And if it wasn't for his sudden death by heart attack, he possibly was going to be the new map, you know, a map from where to start to sort of think more about transmissions of forms, persistence of them, conflict in images or conflict through expressed through images, resistance, and you know, all these sort of the dynamics of culture that, according to Warburg, was possible to look at only through visual materials. Thank you.
In your beautiful editorial work on the correspondence between Abby Warburg and Franz Boas, which came out 2007, I believe, in Res, the Journal of Anthropology and Aesthetics. This is a text about, you introduce the correspondence between Boas and Abby Warburg by saying, and I quote you here, "The correspondence between Warburg and Boas casts an interesting light on the dialogue between art history and anthropology during the first decades of the 20th century. During this momentous period in the history of the disciplines, when the boundaries between them were being erected as part of their institutionalization within museums and university, the divergence of Warburg's cultural history from Boas' cultural anthropology became apparent through their exchange of views on methodology." So I would like to invite you to shed some light on the way the professionalization of both anthropology and art history have erected this wall between these two sister disciplines in a certain way.
Yes.
And if you can connect that a little bit to where you see the Warburgian legacy today in reanimating that kind of conversation between art history and anthropology.
Yes. Oh, that's really interesting, Tarek. That was a study that came out of a 6 months postgraduate that I had at in New York at Columbia University, and the project of my research was then to dig into Boas's work that made then possible the publication of Primitive Art of 1927. And I'd already seen Boas' papers kept at the Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. And this is where I found the two letters that then I published. They are part of, I think, 17 letters. It has been a long time ago now. I haven't been back on that
for a long time.
I'm really grateful that you sort of forced me to go back to that.
That's my job.
So the idea was really to, because what struck me was that actually Boas' Primitive Art was the first comprehensive attempt to give some methodology in reading non-Western arts at such an early stage, when non-Western art was actually becoming really interesting for artists, Cubism, Surrealism, and so I thought that was really interesting. So what my question was, whether is Boas actually acquainted with Western art methodologies, and if so, is he in which one would he be interested? Because we know that by then, so we are at the end of the 20s, university, art history was taught in university, but there were different sort of declination of it, different schools. So there was the formalistic school, Heinrich Berlflin, the more museum oriented school, the Vienna school, and then there was the Warburg. So there were these schools. So I really was interested to see that also because Boas and Warburg had this letter exchange in the 20s. And so just when actually Boas was writing at least the first part of Primitive Art, because we know that the second part is just the publication of the essays that he wrote in, I think published in 1897. So what is really interesting here is the first part, so the part in which Boas tries to be an art historian, sort of divides his topic into, meaning, representation, and trying to give sort of some rules through which to look and judge, aesthetically judge what was native art production that then, of course, he had been collecting for decades by then, for the North American Museum's collection of North American art. So I thought that was really interesting. But after the reading of the correspondence, what came out was that Although Warburg tried to make Boas interested in his own project and methodology, and in the way he himself read the meaning and the form of some Pueblo objects that he himself had collected and then donated to the Volkerkunde Museum in Hamburg, Boas was completely distant from Warburg's approach. He didn't believe that you could actually think of an idea given as a universal idea. Let's say the feathered serpent, the feathered snake. So Warburg's question was, is this Zuni object which I collected similar, or can we think that actually its form is a Nachleben, a survival of an old Mesoamerican form which is linked to human sacrifice, blah, 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 blah. So a sort of a very comparative idea of culture, that you put pieces together by comparison and also by tracing a possible Ur form, to the beginning of the form, up in time and space. So in relation to that, Boas was really transient, as you may have read in the letter which he writes back, in which the first he dismisses completely such an attitude. So he first says, well, I'll ask the expert, the Pueblo, the Zuni expert on that. You know, I'll ask him or her, I think it was Cluse Parsons, I'll ask her what she thinks about that specific use in that specific culture. But I tend not to approve of this sort of very large interpretation, because what is really relevant is the specific context of use and production. So Boas seems, so Boas doesn't look like to be particularly interested in Warburg's own ideas about images, whilst is very interested on Alois Riegel's concept of Kunstwollen, which is, I think in English, we may translate it as a will of art.
Will to art.
Yeah. So there is this impulse, this creative impulse for which, you know, each artist in creating an object, he's creating an object of art, because he's trying to give form to sort of an impulse and an artistic impulse. So the Kunstwollen concept is really interesting, though, for non-Western art reception, because basically it destroys any prejudicial look towards forms of art that are not canonical, which by end of 19th century meant classical art, Renaissance art, and Jugendstil. So there were, you know, very well defined the material culture that you could call art, and all the rest that was in fact artifacts or, you know, objects. So the Kunstwollen meant that Riegel, for instance, was the first to study the production of late Roman Empire, which coincides with medieval, early medieval time, or other forms of art. So it opened up to all the non-Western perception of art. And so that's what really Boas treasures as a tool for understanding native art. So that's to, I think, for the first part of your question. How does Warburg's methodology in reading art, how it is, how it has influence, and if it has influence on contemporary research, anthropologically based? Well, that's a question that maybe I should be the one to ask.
So So I think I find your answer really useful in many regards. First, it helps me clarify my position vis-a-vis classical anthropology and vis-a-vis Boas in particular. And I think this work that you've done on the correspondence between Boas and Warburg tells me a couple of things. First, it tells me that Franz Boas is a towering figure in the 1920s at the time where they are having this conversation. And you can sense from the conversation how much Warburg is deferential and highly respectful of Boas. There's almost a sense that he's intimidated by him. And then he's seeking him out. I mean, he asks him, I think, 15 questions in one of the letters.
Yes, and he's never happy with the response. So he goes back, asking him again. And in fact, at a certain point, when he can't, you know, get Boas any longer, Boas sends to Hamburg one of his pupils. You know, Boas has this thing that he had all female researcher, which he really nourished, which is great. Yeah. So that generation of anthropologists has been mainly female. Yes. So Gladys Rachard was sent to Hamburg to study the Melanesian collection for her book that was then published in 1933. And, you know, she gets in contact with Warburg, and Warburg is on her, you know, constantly asking her things that he would have liked Boas to. But by then, Boas was a star.
Mm-hmm. And it's also really interesting to see how Warburg asks questions to Boas that Boas had already answered in previous articles that certainly Warburg had read, at least I surmise that he might have read them. In particular, the text that came out in 1896, I believe, called On the Limitations of the Comparative Method in Anthropology, which is an important text that came out in Science, where it is very clear that Boas can never be open to the kind of logic of image or the curatorial logic that we were talking about that takes montage as its basis.
Yes.
But I think you can see the way Boas answers or does not answer Warburg's question, how he's, and I think you mentioned that as well in your introduction, that he's almost recalcitrant to Warburg's visual method, right? So I am really curious to see why Boas' understanding of the comparative method and his critique of the comparative method that was used in the late 19th century until his own intervention was in a way the very kind of montage that Warburg is interested in. In other words, what Boas critiques, which is comparing, for example, the Quetzalcoatl in Mexico and let's say images of the snake in ancient Greece, Asclepius, for example. Right? I mean, that's a montage that Warburg would do, right? Or when he talks, there's a beautiful plate.
Yes.
It's plate number 8 in the atlas. It's on the concepts of infinitude. And he shows how the idea of infinitude has moved from a pictorial basis to a mathematical and more of a semiotic basis. But he compares various places, Persia, ancient Greece, and then he moves to other non-Western cultural forms. Boas is interested in contiguity. Boas is interested in comparing things that have a certain kind of affinity to them. So he would compare, I don't know, Morocco and Tunisia because they are in close proximity. But if you started comparing Tunisia with Argentina, Boas would raise a red flag. What do you think of this?
Well, you know, I'm thinking about the first panel, the panel A of the Atlas, which basically, from what you're saying, you make me think that actually that's from the point of view of Warburg in making it, in mounting it, is a sort of an homage to Boas' idea of cultural area. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, which is that portion of territory where ideas and habits, tools, traditions, language circulate in dynamics. And so this sort of all these things are reshuffled continuously to create new different declination, but starting from the same premises. So the panel A has basically three big images. On the top, there is the sky. So the sort of representation of the sky through an astrological map. Then there is a geographical map, which is the Mediterranean area. So that's a geographical area, as given by Boas, which is basically the area where cultural artifacts that interests Warburg are born and circulate from antique time, which means 7th century before Christ, up to early 20th century. So that's a statement that's saying, you know, I'm interested in that. In fact, there are no photographs of the American journey in the Atlas, because that's, you know, the Pueblo, that experience was really very far away from that cultural area. And then the last image is the genealogical tree of the Tornabuoni and Medici family. So moreover, within the Mediterranean area, I'm actually focusing on something which do very much with humankind. In this particular case, you know, a Florentine-based family of 15th century. So maybe, you know, maybe Warburg was so interested in Boas, and at a certain point, he did recognize that his effort in trying to link, so, you know, he was really outside his field by the end, Warburg, by posing a question regarding the form of this feathered snake in Mesoamerican culture. He was far out what it was, his understanding of, you know, art and cultural artifacts. So, but I think that it may be that, you know, Boas' very harsh reply has sort of led him to think that, well, in considering an oeuvre like the Atlas, I really want to point out that it has a contextual, precise sort of basis, which is, you know, a time zone and a geographical time, and this idea that you start from the stars, so from the idea, and you go down to how mankind deal with that. Because by the end, you know, this idea of the cure, which I find in your text, this idea of, you know, the act of creating as taking care and cure maybe oneself as well, is something which is very present in Warburg as a humankind, as a man himself.
I think that there is also a pan-psychic understanding of how certain states of mind reappear in the form of motifs in images, but images that are not necessarily artistic images.
Oh no, that wasn't, you know, that isn't a premises. You know, images can be whatever, advertisements or...
Exactly. So this is where I think, whereas Boas's primitive art is really an attempt to flesh out what we call today the anthropology of art as a subdiscipline, with a focus on non-Western art. But I think that Warburg's focus, it seems to me, is psychoanalytical to a certain extent. It is cinematic also, through the reappropriation of the concept of montage. But it seems to me that when I read Warburg, or when I look at the way he curates these images, with all of these etymological understanding of curation, cure, care, incurable, and so on, it seems to me that for Warburg, there is a kind of a therapeutic act that takes place through the curatorial logic of thinking about the Nachleben, or the survival of certain forms. So the operation is very interesting. He takes the notion of survival from E.B. Tyler. So this is Victorian. Yes. This is Victorian anthropology.
Yes, very much.
And then he courts Boaz, and he courts him, but there's a limit in that courtship. I think that there is a misunderstanding that is productive that takes place in their correspondence, as I understand the work that you're doing on it. And then you have the towering figure of Panofsky and then Gombrich later on, who seem to pacify the intensity that Warburg brings into his curatorial logic of images. So to me, Boaz, Gombrich, and Panofsky appear to me rather conservative, for lack of a better word, in contrast to Warburg. And so why does Warburg seek out Boaz? Is it because Boaz legitimizes his relationship to anthropology? Does it give him a certain kind of authority that he felt he didn't have as an art historian?
I think so. I think that may be the reason. You know, Boaz came from a similar background, well, a different, but he was German Jewish. Mm-hmm. Very influential by the 20s. Those anthropologists that Warburg had met during his journey 30 years before were dead or were superseded completely by the new sort of methodology of cultural anthropology of Boas. People like James Mooney, Walter Fuchs, Cushing, you know, those who were working for Smithsonian Institution in these surveys of what was a different year. So they were all dead. So basically they belong to a generation that Warburg had, with whom Warburg had found some really sort of interesting exchange. So Boas was left. He was very influential. He came from this German background. He was very concerned on political and ethical issues. He'd been working on problems of definition of race. Mm-hmm. And so being a Jew in Hamburg, those were all questions of extreme interest. And Warburg had always had the ambition of taking active part in the sort of civic and political life of his city. In the 1910s, he sort of hopes to open a university in Hamburg, which then opens in 1919. And that's where Panofsky comes in, because Panofsky then was teaching there art history. And so in 1909, 1910, he proposes the Council of Hamburg to open up a university structure in order to make intellectual history and also to avoid a mere mercantilistic bourgeois ethic, which he despised because he thought that, you know, learning was the main thing, really. And so Boas, by the end, was very influential, and his writings were well known in Germany as well. And so Warburg was hoping to find an ally on various levels. On a political level, on a sort of, or more on an intellectual level, and hopefully maybe someone who would be happy to have him as a scholar, as a visiting scholar in US for teaching his methodology of, you know, anthropology of images. And which Boas didn't take up. Walter Stimilli has been writing on the Warburg's American journey, the planned American journey that wasn't then possible. But reading Stimilli's and also reading what, you know, the letters, the correspondence, it seems that really Warburg wanted to go and colonize America's art history. And in fact, that was done by Panofsky's in the 30s and not by him. And of course, Panofsky's discourse is, you know, is very reductive. reductive to a certain extent of some of the issues that Warburg had put forward and that have been not considered anymore up until the 80s. And of course, you know, I think of Didi Huberman's readings of Warburg's papers, either archival or written essays, the link to psychoanalysis that Didi Huberman has shown, the interest of Salvatore Sacchi's Kurt Foster, Philippe Panemi's show that was, you know, the one that together with Didi, I think in the 90s, when the archive of the Warburgs were finally open, has worked on this particular idea of montage, mm-hmm. you know? So putting in the Warburg oeuvre of the Atlas within the context of filmography, of modernist filmography. So again, you know, presenting a scholar that was becoming a curator mm-hmm. of his own materials and building up a possible, you know, a possibility of talking about images, with images, mm-hmm. that was up until then not understood or accepted by conventional scholarship.
Talk a little bit about Warburg's use of photographic imagery in particular and his relationship to photography. What is his relationship to someone like Edward Curtis, for example? are there understanding of cultural difference or difference tout court, something that, you know, you could say something about?
Yeah, well, it's funny that you mentioned Curtis because his portfolios were, you know, such a great project that never came to an end, mm-hmm. because obviously it was too expensive basically to do something like that. But it's really interesting from the point of view of editorial project, mm-hmm. the idea of having loose photographs in portfolios was something extraordinary for those times. But I think that the image that Curtis has given us, and which stood for many, many decades,
they're really powerful images.
Yeah, but you know, the image of the Indian tribes has something where there is no evidence of history sort of going through.
They're timeless. Yeah.
Yeah, they're timeless, they're in this sort of Eden, which is the natural landscape, these incredible monumental landscapes. And they seem to be like, you know, lost souls in an historical time frame. So all that is very, you know, is false, is fake, is a project, you know.
They're reenactments also.
Exactly. So it's what we call set photography, in fact, today's in contemporary photographic practice. And so Warburg uses of, you know, when he goes to the Pueblo villages in Arizona, New Mexico, Hopi, Zuni, Pueblos, and He has a Kodak number one camera with him, which means one of the first Kodaks that were produced, you know, one of that which was publicized by "We press the button, you press the button, we do the rest." So basically you had this box and, you know, you just shot and then you send the film and then they'll give back the prints. So when he took nearly 200 photographs of his journey, and those that are most well known are the one of the Pacina dance in the Oraibi square. But his photographs are really blurred. They're really snapshots. You know, he didn't know very much how to use a camera because apparently that was the first time he uses it. But nevertheless, he collected photographs. So he had an idea of what was the sort of the aesthetics of the Southwest by then, but he never collects Curtis photographs. So that sort of gaze, which also has very much to do with pictorialist photography in terms of print, tonality,
relationship to painting and so on. Yeah,
so he has no interest to him at all. In fact, what he's interested in is photographs, which we have partially published in a volume, Photographs of the Frontier, which was published by the Warburg Institute in 1996 at the end of the research project. There is a series of photographs in which he takes portraits of the children which were forced to attend governative school in at Kings Canyon, in this place which was in the valley before the mesas. And so there are these portraits which are taken, they're very similar to a sort of a criminology sort of photography. So they're 2x2, and so he records what was hidden away. So Curtis would have never actually shown the conflict within the colonization of native tribes by Western culture, while Warburg sort of dwells on that. And he dwells on the fact that there is a Western broom in a Hopi house, all those signs that usually anthropologists tended to erase. Boas as well, you know, Boas as well does that. He erases the clock in a tent of the Hamatatsa dance or whatever ritual. So, you know,
Robert Flaherty in Nanook of the North, it faced all of these signifiers of modernity, let's call them.
You know. Exactly. And it is the signifiers that are maybe a good link for this psychotic idea of the images that sort of survives. Because, you know, Warburg is really very attentive to minor, apparently minor pieces of information. But are those pieces of information, those details that actually can reveal a world, a concept of the world that is not so much evident in the spoken language, for instance. You know, if you talk to maybe the woman who owned the brougham in the Oraibi house, she would possibly talk about kachinas and traditions and would, you know, dismiss the broom. But in fact, the fact that the broom was there meant that civilization, colonization was already there by then. So those are sort of hints through which understanding changes and cultural conflicts. And are those hints that are really of interest of Warburg. So when he talks about the nymph, you know, these pagan female figures that suddenly enters the room of a Renaissance where the scene of the birth of St. John the Baptist is reenacted. When what has that nymph has to do with that? Well, it has to do because in that particular moment in 15th century culture, all of a sudden, the texts that were hidden away by Christianity were finally circulating again. And so the nymph was just one of the figures that was emerging from the classical world and changing, in fact, by its interaction, the modern Renaissance world conception of life.
Now that's a beautiful way to put it, Benedetta. I think we should conclude with a few words about this wonderful project, and it's a collaborative project called Abby Warburg, An Unexpected Influencer. Could you tell us a little bit about this project and about your collaborator, who you are doing it with, and what do you hope to achieve with this project?
Well, what we do hope to achieve, we don't know. We'll see. It's an open process of understanding whether in contemporary practice, in lens-based, basically, but not only. So we're interested in scenographies, theatre, writings, anthropology, of course, architecture, editorial works, books, design, whether there is, where it is possible to look at those projects through a lens of some of Warburg's topics in reading and using images. So basically what we've done, it has been a couple of years now, and me and Chiara Capodici, who owns a fantastic small but very, very rich bookshop.
I can't wait to visit it.
Photography bookshop in Rome called Leporello, which is really sort of one of these places of the city where you breathe constantly of new ideas. So me and Chiara were confronted by our work with contemporary photographers by the fact that Warburg has entered a sort of a frame of reference for people, you know, active with photography or creating photography shows or designing photography books. So, and because the reference for, you know, Warburg has always been a reference within the academic world, but not in the sort of contemporary practice of artists doing things. So we wanted really to open up a survey, which we called An Unexpected Influencer, Abby Warburg as a Muse for Contemporary Visual Culture, which we thought was funny, but also telling what we meant by it. So we filled up a questionnaire and an introduction to some of the topics that were interesting for those working with a lens-based or on lens-based project, and decided to send it to 100 people that we knew were, you know, we knew that they must have been attracted by it, even if they were unconsciously working on according to a Warburgian method. And so we found many that were unconsciously working on that, and some, and you are one of those that were consciously knowing what we were talking about. And so we asked to respond by submitting one project, or at least one, but even more than one, and in which it was evident, a visual, mainly visual project, in which it was evident their link to some of the topics that we discussed about just now. So survival, persistence, conflict, dynamisms of images within cultural settings, or blah, blah, blah. And so we'd asked photographers, creators, and so all the others that I already mentioned. And today, we've got a blog, at Leporello's homepage, that you can find Leporello's homepage, and we've gathered 41 interviews, and so 55 project visual projects. And also what we'd asked, in order to be coherent with Warburg gatherings of materials, which, as we just said, were books and images representing artworks or productions, objects, to list, so to select some title that would widen up our initial bibliography, so to build sort of a ideal reference library for those who are interested in working with images through a research on the archive or archives, and through a juxtaposition, so a sort of montage of them in their own projects. So this library has grown and grown and grown, and I was just checking just before this conversation that we are now at 476 books. And of course, some of those are sort of standard reference books that every one of us knows, so Didier Oberman or Philippa Lemichaud. But then, you know, things came out like Lacan. For someone, Lacan was interesting, and for others was interesting James Joyce. You know, the Ulysses of James Joyce was really relevant for their procedures in relation to our survey. So that has given us the sense that there are many contemporary practice that can be affiliated, because I don't like to talk about influenced, because, you know, influence is a tricky concept. So that can be affiliated, or that can that we can say that sort of come from that sort of attitude towards image, and that are developing into new project, whether it is reshuffling of non-official archives through the net. So we've got some beautiful project, a project on the image of Mars, and by this artist who has gathered all the net images and fake or not or whatever found on the net, or people working on the dark web, or, you know, or people just thinking back, photographers thinking back at their work through this new lens. And therefore things have come out, like in the work of Guido Guidi, who's a documentary photographer, it has come out this fascinating attitude of his towards early Renaissance paintings, which is exactly on the same things that Warburg was pointing out. So, you know, we've got, and also more playful stands like Claire Strand, reshuffling of images which she collected in time, which is very interesting as well, people who have contributed by sort of sharing their ongoing projects. So projects that came out of our survey and are just developing into new things. And so we're gathering lots of things that have been done already, but I've been rethought of under this new lens, new projects, and new ideas for, you know, developing further this survey, which it's going to be, I think, very, very interesting then at a certain point when we'll, you know, when we'll give a halt to it, to see what we can do with it. But even without having to do much with it, it's still a very interesting response. And of course, you know, the archive, whatever the archive is the photographic archive is one of the sort of issues, the main subject there.
Well, it certainly is a wonderful project. I follow it on the Leporello blog site, but I also follow it on Instagram. And some of this information will be on the radio show's webpage as well. Benedetta, I would like to conclude by and thank you by saying that I like the two words that you used in as you were describing an unexpected influencer. It's playfulness. I think that that there is a great deal of playfulness in montage, in addition to all of the traumatic and existential dimension of montage. And then also I like the way you talk about the curatorial aspect of this project in terms of attitude, or another term that I I find extremely important is the term ethos, right? So there's an ethos of curation, an ethos of images that is foregrounded in this project. And I am learning a great deal through all of the participants' interventions and the amazing bibliography that you are putting together. I can't wait to be in Rome and visit the bookstore itself and to continue this conversation. So I would like to thank you very much for being...
Thank you. All right. Thank you. And I really hope that, the project will... Well, I wanted to say that it is, in fact, an open call to projects. So on the Leporello blog, dedicated to an affected influencer, and who's got a project, can upload his own or her own project. So we are, we're dealing with lots of things that we didn't expect and are very welcomed, because the attitude you were mentioning is really a frame of mind which I think it's very much bred in curiosity and, sort of a great deal of curiosity in regards to what people do with images. Thank you.